The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Istanbul's airport attacked today on the world. There have been multiple casualties in an attack on Istanbul's airport. Two suicide bombers allegedly detonated explosives.
Right now, reports are that they had detonated before they were able to fully enter the terminal, right at the entrance security.
And we stay on Brexit and why it appeals to a particular British mindset.
Feminism was on the whole a bad thing. Multiculturalism was on the whole a bad thing. The internet on the whole is a bad thing. People who are very nostalgic for England and for a Britain that they feel is slipping away from them.
Plus, you know those balloons at birthday parties? Some scientists say stop using helium.
Without it, really, we would be at a complete loss. And the big problem is that helium is not a renewable resource.
Those stories ahead on The World. Thanks for being with us today. We have news out of Turkey. There's been a double bombing at the airport in Istanbul. We'll hear more about that later in the show. But first, ever since Britain's vote last week to quit the EU, there's been turmoil in Brussels, the heart of the European Union. And today, European leaders met in Brussels to try to pick up the pieces. Among them was none other than Nigel Farage, one of the main cheerleaders for the so-called Brexit. He's a member of the European Parliament for UKIP, the UK Independence Party. And today, he basically thumbed his nose at his European colleagues.
Isn't it funny? You know, when I came here 17 years ago and I said that I wanted to lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, you all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you?
No, not so much. The president of the European Commission, Jean-Claude Juncker, welcomed Farage and said the democratic will of the British people must be respected. There was polite applause. Farage joined in on it. And then Juncker let Farage have it.
That's the last time you are applauding here. And to some extent, I'm really surprised that you are here. You were fighting for the exit. The British people voted in favor of the exit. Why are you here?
Tara Palmieri is a reporter for Politico in Brussels, and she was there for that exchange. Tara, where did the exchange go from there? Did Farage have a comeback?
Farage was really feisty today. He actually told the members of European Parliament that they've never held a proper job in their lives, which did not go over so well. He said that they were in denial. He really was throwing punches. I mean, he was the winner in this battle, so I think he didn't need to come out like that. It seemed like he was really just laying it on a little too thick, too, especially considering that the rest of them are going to pretty much vote on the terms of the divorce between the UK and 27 others. So I thought that was actually strategically not in the best interest of the UK, but at the same time, this is his shtick. This is his meal ticket. He's been arguing for Brexit for the past 18 years. So I guess he wants to take his victory lap, and he did it.
Now, in that audience today in the European Parliament, was there any audible support for Nigel Farage and for the Brexit?
Of course. I mean, they're not the only ones. There are Eurosceptic movements growing all over Europe at this point, in Netherlands, Czech Republic, France. It's not an isolated or contained thing at this point. It's actually considered kind of a contagion. So, yes, there was some delight to hear them, but there was probably more booing because the majority of people that go into Parliament believe in the European project and want to see it succeed.
Do any of the politicians and bureaucrats at the European Union and in the European Parliament, do any of them feel like the great European project is actually in trouble, in real trouble?
Absolutely. They all do, I'm sure. I mean, it's devastating for people who believe in a federal Europe, in a United States of Europe, you could say, to lose a member state. It's like for the U.S. to lose Texas or something like that. So, yeah, they're devastated. They're also just worried about keeping the entire project together. If they lose France, I mean, that could be the end because France and Germany are the core countries. And so right now there's a lot of political maneuvering to keep it together, to show that exiting is not the way to a more prosperous future, and that the EU is the path for, you know, economic growth, a handle on the migration crisis and other problems that Europe is facing right now.
You mentioned France, but support for a Frexit or whatever you would call it, I mean, that's very low. I mean, it's Marine Le Pen and her party, but it doesn't extend much beyond that, does it?
No, it does. I mean, they're polling at 27%. A Eurobarometer poll showed that the French are actually more Eurosceptic than the Brits. So, no, I would disagree with you on that point.
But there's been no talk yet of a referendum, has there? There's been no talk.
She's been pushing for it. She's definitely been pushing for it. If anyone is the most panicked, it's François Hollande.
He is by far, of France.
He is by far the most panicked. His polling numbers are extremely low right now.
It's so interesting because all the news today is about, you know, Nigel Farage being there and the kind of interplay between the British mm-hmm. officials. And then you have the kind of stereotype of the EU also at work, which is the first order of business was talking about regulating weed killers across Europe. I mean, is it sort of grist for the mill of Eurosceptics?
Exactly. I mean, sometimes a lot of people are saying we need to focus on the big things, but somehow people tend to get lost in the weeds here. I don't know if it's special interests that lead them there or the bubble, just the fact that this place is sort of a looking glass. They have a very introspective view of how Europe is. And it's actually, to me, a little strange. I think that it would probably do them some good to spend more time with the people that elected them, to be honest, to know what they really care about.
Tara Palmieri there with Politico in Brussels. Nigel Farage is one of the names we've been hearing a lot this week. The other is Boris Johnson. They're the two politicians who probably had the biggest influence on the Brexit vote. To get more context on these two men, we turn to Helen Lewis in London. She's deputy editor of The New Statesman. Helen, let's start with Nigel Farage. Tell us a little bit about him.
He's probably the most important single-issue campaigner in recent British political history. So he has been leader of the UK Independence Party since 2006. He's been a member of the European Parliament for UKIP since 1999. And during that time, he has basically had one mission in life, which is to make Britain leave the European Union. And on Friday, he got that wish. He's an interesting character in terms of British politics. So he left school at 16. He worked in the city as a trader. And his big thing in politics really has been the idea that he's always felt that Conservatives and Labour and Lib Dems, the other three main parties, have all been, basically, they've all had the same attitude, for example, to things like immigration. So, you know, he thinks that there's a kind of consensus that he is there to break. And actually, I think that the result on Friday probably vindicated that view. You know, you had the Labour leader, the Conservative leader, the Lib Dem leader, all advocating Remain, and yet that is not the view that prevailed in the end.
Is Farage considered a divisive figure in Britain?
Yeah, absolutely. The big thing that's always said about him is he is a 15% politician. So UKIP won 4.5 million votes at the last general election. To put that in perspective, you know, you need about 11-12 to win. However, because of our parliamentary system, which means that you have to win individual constituencies, individual areas, he only ended up with one MP. So that is a big source of resentment that that's not reflected in the makeup of the Commons. But equally well, that, you know, he is never going to form a majority government. He's never going to break past a certain point. And that's partly because for all the people that absolutely love him, think he's a plain spoken truth teller, you know, he's sticking it to the establishment, there are a lot of people who find him, I think what we sort of hear called a golf club bore, somebody who is a, you know, he drinks. I mean, he's very proud of the amount that he drinks and he smokes, and he, you know, he's quite blokey in that sense. And, you know, people love that, and then other people hate that.
Now let's talk about Boris Johnson. I mean, he was a pro-leaver too, but he's much more kind of Oxbridge, kind of posh, isn't he?
Yeah, he got a scholarship to the, perhaps I would say, the most notorious public school in Britain, Eton, which is also the school that our Prime Minister David Cameron went to. You know, this is a school where people wear kind of top hats and tailcoats. It's very traditional, incredibly traditional. And so that's a big, you know, that's a big question mark over him about his background. So he got a scholarship there. From there, he went to Oxford, where he was in a club called the Bullingdon Club, a drinking society with the Prime Minister David Cameron. So there's been lots of kind of slightly, you know, wry jokes about how amazingly power has shifted in Britain from, you know, two people that have known each other since university and have known each other since school, even. You know, so this is not quite the big kind of establishment shakedown that's happening in Britain that you might think. But he is, you know, he's a journalist at his heart, you know, and I say that as another journalist. He's a very interesting politician to us because, you know, he's now adopted a kind of slightly sober statesman-like guise, but we've known him for quite a long time as a slightly clownish figure. I mean, he got stuck on a zip wire. He made a strange speech at the end of the Beijing Olympics about how whiff-waff, which is what most people would call ping pong, table tennis, was coming home. It was really a British sport. And, you know, we had been used to thinking of him as a bit of a joker, but, you know, I think comparisons with Donald Trump are slightly overblown, although they both got a lot of blonde hair and they both changed their positions a lot of time. But I think he has the same thing in that he was somebody people didn't used to take seriously, and now they very much have to.
Is that image of being kind of a buffoon and, you know, being stuck on a zip wire and all that kind of stuff, is it an image he's cultivated and it's hiding a kind of very, you know, basically just an ambitious politician, or is it genuine?
Yeah, that's always been the big question about whether or not how much of it is an act and how much of it is actually the fact that he is quite scruffy and declines to, you know, wear suits or brush his hair. I think it's become now, it's really his calling card. You know, he's one of the very few British politicians that we can put on the cover of the magazine and people instantly know who he is. You know, in the same way that you put a picture of, you know, you actually just see a picture of Donald Trump's hair and you know you're talking about it. If you put a picture of of Boris Johnson's hair, you know, on a figure, then it's just so recognisable. He has become iconic. So he is now, he came out on Friday morning looking like an undertaker. He looked, you know, absolutely quite miserable. But this is a part of a remaking of him as the new statesman-like Boris. You know, he wants to show that although, yes, he has been happy to clown around, he is also a serious contender.
Helen Lewis is with the British magazine The New Statesman. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
There's a joke going around today. It goes like this. Only England could leave Europe twice in 1 week. First the Brexit vote, and then last night's shocking loss to Iceland in the Euro 2016 soccer tournament. The tiny island, population 320,000, beat mighty England 2-1. Or look at it this way. England, the world's wealthiest soccer team, lost to a team managed by a part-time dentist.
We are over the moon. When we woke up this morning, and now I'm talking about the whole nation, we still thought that we were dreaming.
That's Icelandic TV personality Inga Lind Karlsdóttir. But the victory was no dream. And this Iceland fan, Hannah, says she has a ready answer for English friends who ask her how Iceland could win such a match.
The difference between our team is that the Icelandic team plays with their heart. And they were like, what? Don't you think we play with our hearts and our players, you know? And I said, yes, of course, they play for their queen and country. But, you know, we have a bigger heart. That's why we won.
For England, the loss was hard to swallow. The team's manager, Roy Hodgson, resigned immediately after the match. That prompted one British paper to use the headline, Brexit Hodgson. Other headlines in the British press, England exit in humiliation. And, God help us, a sly nod to the importance of fishing in Iceland, apparently. It all puts Þórður Eiríkur Óskarsson in a difficult place. He's Iceland's ambassador to the UK. And when asked by the BBC about the match, Óskarsson had this to say.
You have all these wonderful names, wonderful players, but something didn't happen for them yesterday.
A diplomatic blend of tact and understatement there. Óskarsson then gave a nod to Iceland's fans.
We have a small group of very dedicated fans called Tolvan in Icelandic, that means the 12th player. And they developed this interesting Viking reminding hymn, so to speak.
That was the Iceland team leading fans in the Viking hymn after the game last night. Thousands of fans who gathered in the middle of Reykjavik to watch the match chanted along as well. Iceland goes back into battle on Sunday. That's when they take on the host nation, France, in Paris. I'm sure Iceland's 12th man will have Thor's hammer at the ready. We have photos of Iceland's historic win up on our website. Think Viking beards, grown men crying, and happy little blonde babies. Just head over to PRI.org to check those out. Coming up in a bit, a giant underground cache of helium in Tanzania, here on The World. Sometimes a story breaks that pushes everything off the news radar for us, like Britain's vote to leave the EU. We'd planned to wrap up our series on the rising seas last Friday, but then Brexit got in the way. So we're going to get back to it now. We have a story today about how climate change is going to cost the world billions, maybe trillions of dollars. But at least some of that cost is also an economic opportunity. Last week, we talked about efforts by the Dutch to share their expertise in dealing with the impact of rising sea levels. Those efforts are partly altruistic, but also partly commercial. There's a lot of money to be made here. One of the places the Dutch have been working with is the city of Norfolk, Virginia. And now businesses, universities, and local officials in Norfolk are picking up on what the Dutch are doing, and they're seeing the business potential of climate change, too. From our environment desk, here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
Proximity to the water has long been a big selling point in Norfolk real estate. The city sits low on the coast, right by the Chesapeake Bay. But these days, that proximity has actually started to become a liability.
The first question we get in most cases is it in a floodplain? And if so, how much is the insurance?
That's Norfolk real estate broker Kathy Heaton. She's showing me an empty two-story house in a desirable Norfolk neighborhood. She was about to close on this place 2 years ago when the sale hit a snag.
We're in the inspection. The agent gets a phone call and finds out that the flood insurance premium on this house would be $3,800 a year, way above what anybody who was going to buy this house could afford.
That's when Heaton called in this guy.
My name is Mike Vernon. I'm an expert in flood mitigation and flood insurance.
Vernon runs a business aimed at reducing people's flood insurance premiums. He sees an opportunity in the same thing that scared away this home's buyer.
The opportunity is here because flood insurance premiums are going to increase. So I think that more and more people are going to become more and more motivated to look towards mitigation.
Flood insurance premiums are likely to increase because the sea level in and around Norfolk is rising fast. It could go up as much as 6 feet by the end of the century, and the area is already seeing more flooding. Some people have responded to the risk by raising their homes to lower the flood risk, but Vernon takes a different approach.
This used to go to, that was a landing to get out the side door.
In the Norfolk home's kitchen, Heaton opens a door that used to lead to a basement. Now there's just a piece of drywall blocking the stairs. Vernon installed a drainage system and flood vents down there and then filled the basement in with sand.
Once we put in the sand and vented the crawl space area, the rating for flood insurance went up almost 12 feet.
And that rating change made the annual flood insurance premium go down from about $3,800 to about $400. Vernon's new flood mitigation business is still struggling, but he thinks his customer base will rise along with worries about rising sea levels and insurance premiums.
When we get that word out, I think that my business will be booming.
Globally, one recent estimate found the cost of protecting the world's shoreline could reach into the tens of billions of dollars a year by the end of the century. And in Norfolk, Vernon is not the only one who sees that as an opportunity. The region's universities are trying to position themselves as experts in dealing with sea level rise. The city's recent resilience plan includes an economic strategy.
Half empty glass is we've got the highest sea level rise on the East Coast and we're soggy. The half full glass is if we fix it, we can make money off of it.
That's Skip Stiles, head of the conservation group Wetlands Watch. His group recently funded work on a nature-based flood protection plan in one Norfolk neighborhood.
One of the ideas behind this project, it wasn't just this neighborhood, protect the environment.
The bigger idea was to train a generation of architects and engineers who knew how to ease flooding problems.
Can we solve Norfolk's problems and then develop the expertise to make money selling those solutions to Baltimore and Charleston and Savannah?
Basically, Stiles wants to know, why can't Norfolk be the Netherlands of the U.S.? The Dutch make about 2% of their GDP by exporting water expertise. Norfolk's deputy city manager Ron Williams says the city is launching a $12 million Coastal Resilience Laboratory and Accelerator Center in hopes of claiming a piece of that action.
We're looking for innovation to come out of that. We're looking for companies to figure out new techniques, and we have 125 miles of shoreline for them to test it on.
Of course, there's also something vaguely macabre about profiting off impending disaster. Skip Stiles from Wetlands Watch likens these new companies to vultures.
It sort of resembles the big black bird circling overhead. But I think if they bring solutions, so be it. I don't much care.
And it's not like Norfolk is alone in looking for a silver lining in climate change. Adaptation is a growing global business. Everyone from snow machine makers to seed companies are looking to make money off of it. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Norfolk, Virginia.
Carolyn's reporting is part of our series on the rising seas. It's about coping with the effects of rising oceans around the world and how the Dutch are leading the way. We've got more at pri.org/risingseas. Okay, on to some lighter news now, and I apologize in advance for that. Researchers have discovered a vast underground cache of helium in Tanzania. There had been concerns about a worldwide shortage of helium, but this reserve is thought to be enough to meet global demand for about 7 years.
There are huge amounts of helium, it seems, and they've really just scratched the tip of the iceberg.
That's Andrea Sella from University College London. He tells the BBC that the discovery is a big deal because helium isn't just for filling balloons. It's essential for running MRI scanners. The gas cools the huge magnets in those machines, and Sella says it's also used to cool down other scientific equipment, like the Large Hadron Collider at the CERN laboratory.
Without it, of course, there's all kinds of science we couldn't do. You know, great international science projects like CERN become impossible if you don't have the coolant for the magnets.
Global helium supplies have been dwindling in recent years, and the price has skyrocketed. Some scientists have even suggested a ban on helium balloons because the gas is so critical.
Without it, really, we would be at a complete loss. And the big problem is that helium is not a renewable resource.
We can't make helium. We have to find it. And while Sella says there's a lot of helium in the universe, there isn't much here on Earth.
Because the atom is very, very light, at room temperature, the atoms move fast enough to escape like rockets from the Earth's pull of gravity. And so the result is that any helium that we release into the air will inevitably be lost. So the only place we can get helium is from deposits deep underground in these pockets, usually associated with natural gas.
Those pockets are usually discovered accidentally while drilling for gas or oil. But in this case, the British and Norwegian researchers used new techniques specifically designed for finding helium. They found that volcanic activity provides the high heat that's needed to release helium from rocks and trap it closer to the surface. And they hope they can use the technique to find more helium around the world. After all, 7 years can go by very fast. Later in the show, Muslim, Jewish, and Christian clerics set their sights on a combined house of worship in Berlin on the world. I'm Carol Hills. Reports of multiple casualties at Istanbul's main international airport. A Turkish official says two suicide bombers detonated explosives. We'll touch base with our correspondent in Istanbul. That's ahead here on the world.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We have some news out of Turkey now. There's been a bombing at the international airport in Istanbul. We don't have complete information, but reports are coming in that at least 25 people are dead and dozens injured. Reporter Dalia Mortada is in Istanbul.
Right now, officials are saying that there were two suicide bombers that detonated just before they were able to enter the airport. At the airports in Turkey, there are two levels of security, one at the entrance and one inside. Reports are that they had detonated before they were able to fully enter the terminal right at the entrance security.
I know that Turkey's airports have been the target of other bombings. What were the most recent bombings in Turkey?
This is the fourth bombing in Istanbul in 2016. There was a bombing about 3 weeks ago, or a little less than 3 weeks ago, that killed 11 people. There was a bombing in March in central Istanbul that killed five. There was a bombing in January that killed, I believe, 10 or 11, if I remember correctly. And so these have just become more common. But before this year, before the last 12 months, these were rare in Istanbul.
And the perpetrators behind these recent attacks are a mixture of people. Who has claimed responsibility for the most recent bombings?
That's right, yes. Offshoots of the PKK have claimed responsibility. That's the Kurdistan Workers' Party, which the Turkish government is fighting in Turkey's southeast and other parts of the region. ISIS has claimed responsibility, or ISIS sort of lone wolf ISIS followers have said that they have claimed responsibility for past attacks. But at this point, we just don't know who it is.
Dalia, this all comes at a pivotal time for Europe with Brexit and, by extension, Turkey. Remind us about Turkey's role right now in terms of where it sits in relation to Europe.
That's right. Well, so Turkey has this deal with the EU to basically stop the flow of refugees, of migrants into Europe, stopping people from entering Europe, keeping them in Turkey. And in exchange, Europe gives them about $3 billion or 3 billion euros, and also allows for the EU accession talks to move forward. But those accession talks, I mean, have not moved at all since the deal was struck. That being said, there has been a lot of fear whipped up around Turkey and this deal and their entry into the EU.
It seems like some of the sentiment behind the Brexit vote, for example, was a sense of we're an island, we're Britain, and we don't really want the messiness of the continent. And it sort of resonates with today's attack in Turkey, it seems to me.
That could very well be the case. I mean, apparently there were advertisements going around from the Leave campaign that was saying Turkey's joining the EU with this big red background. So I would guess that, you know, is a fear that some people have.
Dalia, you travel in and out of this airport that was attacked today on a regular basis. What are you thinking now?
I'm thinking that this is, I mean, it's sad. Honestly, I'm sad. It's very difficult to see anywhere sort of go through what Istanbul has gone through in terms of being attacked over and over. And, you know, for my personal safety, I mean, this is something that I think about wherever I go. It's not unique to where I am, but it's difficult for sure.
Reporter Dalia Murtada in Istanbul. Thanks for talking with us, Dalia.
Thank you, Carol.
After last week's vote by Britain to leave the European Union, some leavers expressed a sense of regret. But for Andrew Moravchek, the whole Brexit vote has a sense of illusion, as if it's one giant hoax. Moravchek is a professor of politics at Princeton and an expert on the EU. And from his perspective, Britain isn't going anywhere. He says the whole Brexit drama comes down to a Western version of kabuki theater.
Well, kabuki drama is a metaphor we use here in the United States for stylized political rhetoric that is misleading or meaningless. And what I meant by that is that Brexit in Britain has mostly been about domestic politics. It's been about ambitious people, politicians who are seeking domestic political power, particularly people like Boris Johnson, who are seeking to be prime minister, much more than it's really about a thoughtful, systematic effort to improve Britain's position in Europe. And I think that's been true from the start, and we're definitely seeing it now.
Do you mean to say that this whole effort, this whole referendum, was really about politicians trying to get power and they really didn't want an actual Brexit to happen?
I think they may or may not like to see Britain move a little bit further from the European Union, but a full break from the European Union is something that almost no British politician really wants to see.
So it sounds like they were short-sighted, or in the case of Boris Johnson, because theoretically, if he disappoints the very people who followed his lead and backtracks on what the Brexit would mean for Britain, won't he lose domestic political support, the very thing he wants?
Oh, you have great faith in the people, but that might be misplaced. Look at how well Boris Johnson has done by manipulating the British public to put himself in the position he's in. Once he's prime minister, none of the promises or positions he's taken before are necessarily binding on him. This discussion about what Britain's future place will be in Europe will take years. At the very shortest, nothing will be decided before the middle of 2019. That's a long time in politics. And there'll be a long time to sort out precisely what Britain's relationship will be.
The EU is pushing Britain to act quickly to try to avoid the economic uncertainty that's following this vote. But British politicians seem to be stalling. What do you think they're doing?
Well, this is the thing. So British politicians have manipulated the public into a Brexit vote. But this Brexit vote is not, as a concrete policy, viable. So they're going to have to backtrack and find a relatively modest policy that keeps Britain, for practical purposes, in Europe. Brexit, as we imagine it, Britain completely independent from Europe, won't happen and can't happen. And Britain has no interest in pushing the timetable because this is going to be a very delicate negotiation. And the status quo of Britain being in Europe is actually much better than some of the bad scenarios that might come down the line if, for example, the Europeans were really to push Britain out, which would be an economic and political disaster for any British government. So Britain is going to go slow. And fortunately for the British government, they control the timetable. Whatever certain people in Europe say, and not all European leaders want to go quickly, Britain controls that timetable. First, there needs to be a British government in place. Then they need to develop a negotiating position. Then they need to invoke Article 50 of the European Treaty or whatever other clause they're going to use on the basis of which to negotiate. And then the negotiation will take years. And in all that period of time, it's really the British that decide the pace at which they want to move.
It sounds like a really long kabuki drama. I mean, where are we in the performance?
We're at the very beginning. This is going to be a long kabuki drama, as you say. Many people in the press cycle we've had, which is maybe 72 hours long, have already decided that the British are going to pull out of Europe, that this is going to happen quickly, that the Europeans are angry and going to push them out, that it's all been decided. I think we're at the very first step. And as I said, I think it's extremely unlikely that the British are actually going to end up leaving Europe in any real sense of that word. We're only at the very first step.
Andrew Moravchuk directs the European Union program at Princeton University. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Have you heard the one about a priest, a rabbi, and an imam who build a house of worship together? Actually, it's not a joke. It's an ambitious project in the works in the German capital, Berlin. The plan is to build the world's first hybrid church-synagogue mosque. And in a time of growing divisions in Europe, the clergy involved in the project are calling it the House of One. Here's Daniel Estrin with a story from Berlin.
It began with an archaeological discovery. The ruins of Berlin's very first church. It was built in the 13th century and destroyed and rebuilt again and again throughout history. In the 1960s, the communist officials of East Berlin, who had no interest in religion, demolished it. A parking lot was built on top. Recently, Berlin officials were developing the area, and they stumbled upon the medieval foundations. Gregor Hoberg is the pastor at St. Mary's, a Lutheran church a few blocks up the road. He says his parish was so moved by the discovery, they held a worship service on top of the ruins.
Also wir haben einfach gespürt, das ist so ein wichtiger Ort hier mitten in der Stadt. Da steckt so viel Energie drin.
When we came to this place, there we just felt this energy. This was a very moving moment, and we as well felt a responsibility to deal with this authentic place.
But Pastor Hoberg had to deal with reality. Most people in Berlin are secular. Rebuilding Berlin's oldest church in the center of the city might not be very welcomed. So he came up with an idea he thought the city would support. The House of One. Three chapels for the three monotheistic religions surrounding a shared hall.
Dinge sind hier ausgelöst worden. Das ist das eine und das andere ist,
he likened it to the fall of the Berlin Wall. The House of One would tear down the walls between religions, while each religion would keep its own identity. The clergy would support gender equality and tolerance for gays and interfaith dialogue. His parish liked the plan. City officials did too. And he quickly found Jewish partners. One of them is Rabbi Andreas Nachama. He wants to promote interfaith projects like visiting the sick and consoling the bereaved.
And also to prove that these three religions could really live peacefully together.
Pastor Hoberg says it took 2 years to find a Muslim partner. That partner is interfaith activist Imam Kadir Sanje.
The people here have fears about Muslims, about Islam. And it's a chance for us to show them we are peaceful people.
I asked Imam Sanjay why he thought other Muslim clergy declined to participate. He says there are two schools of thought among devout Muslims. One school says everything in life is forbidden unless the Quran and Muslim teachings allow it.
But the right perspective and the Islamic perspective and traditional perspective is to say all of the things in the world is allowed until the things what the Quran and the Sunnah don't allow me. And that's, I think, my world vision. I'm looking at this project and say, there is nothing forbidden. Okay, it's possible.
When the House of One is built, who will come? The three clergy hope it will attract a mix of tourists and locals, and that it will be a hub of interfaith activities. But if the House of One were standing today, the imam admits that the majority of Berlin's Muslims, who are of Turkish origin, would avoid his prayer service, because he's affiliated with the teachings of a Turkish Muslim cleric, Fethullah Gulen, a major foe of the Turkish president in recent years. And he says Muslims of Turkish origin in Berlin tend to align with the Turkish president. Those affiliated with Gulen's movement have been facing a major crackdown in Turkey. And Rabbi Nechama leads the city's only liberal reform synagogue, so he says he may not attract those from other streams of Judaism.
I mean, that's what it is. You know, we take each one as he is, but we'll see what happens, you know, whether this project will be accepted or not. I mean, it's much too early. I mean, let's first have a building, and then we will see whether this project really can succeed.
Not one brick has been laid yet for the House of One. The clergy say they won't start building until they raise 10 million euros. They've raised about a million so far, from Jews and Christians and Muslims from around the world. Their ultimate goal is to raise about 40 million, which Rabbi Nechama says is, quote, almost mission impossible. But they've got a crowdfunding site, and they're applying for German government funding. They're hoping they've got a prayer. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
Before we head to the break, here's a story we're going to hear tomorrow on The World. It's about when a refugee camp is not a refugee camp. Some 70,000 people fled from fighting in Sudan and built their own settlement here in South Sudan. The place is called Yida, and it is not recognized by the United Nations.
Yida is not a refugee camp. You just don't settle refugees in the middle of a military zone, period. But of course, nobody settled them, they came.
Authorities want the Yida residents to move to a different camp run by the UN. But some refugees already there do not recommend it.
The host community is very harsh with us. One time, my children went to the bush to collect firewood. Members of the host community approached them with guns and told them to stop. They chased them until they got back to the camp.
Authorities want the refugees to leave Yida by the end of this week. We'll have that story tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills, and it's The World. Imagine being the first in your family to go to college. There's no path for you to follow, and there's the issue of cost. It can be especially daunting for immigrant students. So dozens of school districts across Texas are trying to have these students earn college credits even before they finish high school. It's a way to expose them to college and save on tuition. KUT's Kate McGee went to see how this works in Laredo, Texas, on the U.S.-Mexico border.
Nearly 100 students enter the gym at Texas A&M International University in Laredo. They're practicing for their graduation. Principal Israel Castilla takes the students through the ceremony.
Okay, so you're going to be shaking hands to 7 people, let's say, and then you have the 3 seconds with the picture.
These students, though, aren't graduating from college, rather high school. But many of them are already halfway toward a college degree, thanks to their school, Laredo Early College High School. It works like this. 2 days a week, students take courses at a college campus with other college students. The rest of the week, they're back at their high school. It's how they simultaneously earn their high school diploma and credit towards a post-secondary degree, for free. It's a big help for low-income and first-generation students, bringing them into the college system and making it more affordable.
And I just saw it as an opportunity to get ahead. Even then, I knew that was coming from humble beginnings, and whatever I could do to help pay for my college, like I was going to take advantage of that.
That's Omero Kos. He's 17 and a senior at the school. At first, Kos felt a little weird being in a college classroom with students who were older than him.
It was scary. as like a 15-year-old kid, like over here with someone like who, like some 20-year-old, 30-year-olds even, like they were college students.
But he got over it and did well. Kos moved to the U.S. from Mexico when he was 3. He's lived in Laredo ever since and calls it home. His father worked construction, his mom cleaned houses and raised Kos and his 5 sisters. Watching his parents work hard made him want to go to college and have more opportunities than they did.
When we came here, my mom did a lot of housekeeping jobs, and I would see these people with big, beautiful houses. I would always think, like, why wouldn't we live in those houses? We didn't have the money for that. If I had a chance to have my family live in houses like that and live peacefully, I wanted to do that. I wanted to create a better home for my family.
Principal Castilla says for many first-generation students, college can seem like an impossible goal. Just 16% of Texans in the heavily Latino Rio Grande Valley have a bachelor's degree or higher. Castilla thinks early college high school programs can help fix that by giving students a jumpstart on college.
It's no longer so far away. It's a lot closer now. You have been successful. You have been excellent in this. Now it's just time for you to move on and to continue pursuing what you started.
Usually, early college high schools partner with community colleges, and students can even earn an associate's degree while still in high school. That means they can immediately enter the workforce after high school graduation. At this school in Laredo, the stakes are a bit higher. The school partners with a 4-year university. Students can earn up to 2 years' worth of college credit, but it means they must keep going after finishing high school to earn a bachelor's degree.
It's instead of those 4 years, now it's 2 years. 2 years with the support you were given. You have to continue it, but you're halfway there to that road.
Homero Kos is the youngest in his family and says he's benefiting from a school program that didn't exist when his sisters were in high school. Most of them didn't get the chance to go to college. It was too expensive, and other responsibilities got in the way. But Kos, he's now graduating with about 2 years' worth of college credit from Texas A&M, a savings of more than $40,000. Next, he plans to study biomedical science. For The World, Kate McGee, Austin.
For first-generation students like Homero Kos, graduating high school can be a milestone for them and their families. Next, we'll hear what it means to one student in Austin, Texas, the first in his family to head to college. He's been helped along the way by Breakthrough Austin, a nonprofit that supports first-generation students get their high school degree. Here's his story.
Sometimes it's really hard being the oldest. You're going through everything first, especially being the first sort of student in the United States, going to a school in the United States. My name is Santiago Santana. I am 18 years old. I'm a senior at Anderson High School, and I'll be attending St. Edward's University next fall. Both of my parents are immigrants. They came from Mexico. My dad, he didn't finish middle school. And my mom, she didn't even finish elementary school. So her family really needed her at home. For them, when they look back at their work experience, they've worked pretty much their entire lives. And they always ingrained it into my brain that education would be your goal to getting a bigger paycheck and getting a and having fun with your career. And it's definitely something that I've learned, and it's something that it's stuck in my head till now, that my parents really helped me, supported me with just striving to just work hard. Like, that's all they really know how to do, work hard and get money. So they sacrificed a lot. They came to a country that they had no idea what was going to happen to them. And they really sacrificed so much for me to be able to pursue my career goals, my education degree, by not being able to go back home. My mother hasn't seen her grandmother in about 20 years. She hasn't seen some of her siblings in about the same amount of time. To be away from your family for that long, it's heartbreaking, because you don't know when your own mother, if your own mother will be there the day after that, or the next week, or the next time you call home. Having to sacrifice your own family at home for the future of the family that you will have, it's something that I will definitely be thankful for and be blessed for the rest of my life.
Santana shared his story with KUT's Kate McGee as part of the world's Global Nation education coverage. And we're going to have the Echocentrics take us out today. That's the latest group project from Austin-based musician Adrian Quesada. And it's another step in his career path that's led him down the road of Latin psychedelic funk. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll see you tomorrow.
Public Radio International.